comprising Strongpoint Isabel and the outlying patrol strongpoint Marcel. Marcel had led such a fugitive existence within the organization of Dien Bien Phu that all the other accounts of the battle have thus far ignored it. Created on January 12, 1954, by a detachment of the 33REI just south of the village of Ban Loi, almost halfway between Isabel and the main positions at Dien Bien Phu, Marcel was later garrisoned by the 434th Thai Company under Master Sergeant Kant until March 14, when he and his small unit fell back to Isabel as enemy pressure began to build up around Ban Loi. Francoise, another such outlying position located 500 yards west of Claudine and held by the 414th White Thai Company under Master Sergeant Comte, held its position until it was abandoned during the night of April 2nd by the demoralized tribesmen who left behind them their weapons and non-commissioned officers. On the left flank of the northern sector, there was Strongpoint Anne-Marie, occupied by the 3rd Thai Battalion under Major Thimonier. Gradually reinforced since it was first occupied on December 7, 1953, Anne-Marie was composed of a half-moon-shaped hill position whose horns faced the enemy hill line. Together, they formed Anne-Marie 1 and 2. The two remaining positions, Anne-Marie 3 and 4, were located in the Dishpan Flat rice fields between the northern tip of the airstrip and Anne-Marie, AM 1 and 2. Both AM 3 and 4 were laid out in a curious triangle formed of three positions shaped like arrowheads grouped around a central headquarters position. AM 4 served as a connecting link between the northern hill position and the rest of Dien Bien Phu. AM 3, on the other hand, rested like a little dot capping the long eye of the airstrip itself. It also lay athwart the Pabi track leading to Gabriel. While it is convenient for purposes of illustration to give the strong points at Dien Bien Phu the amoeba-shaped contours with which they are usually depicted, they were quite different. There was neither a connecting trench system, nor a common belt of barbed wire, nor even minefields which connected all the positions of a strong point. This was particularly true early in the battle, when the newspapers, as well as the French Army's information services, attempted to make the world believe that the French fortress of Dien Bien Phu encompassed the whole valley. In the case of Anne-Marie, AM 1 and 2 were connected with each other, since they were located on one and the same hill, but the other two positions were little worlds of their own, each inhabited by one company of about 130 tribesmen, a few French non-coms, and one French officer. Captain Gendre on AM-3, and Captain Desiree on AM-4. Desiree, whose wife was expecting their first child, the baby girl was born in France on May 4th and promptly baptized Anne-Marie, had acquired a Thai horse, for which his men had dug him a pit. He could be seen going for the unit's mail and to briefings, gaily trotting through the dust on his charger. Like all the other battalions inside the valley, the 3rd BT had its normal complement of 4 81mm mortars, as well as some lighter 60mm, and its machine guns. While Anne-Marie was not rated as an excellent position, it had the advantage of solid backing from almost all sides. To the north, the heavy mortar battery of Gabriel could cover all of Anne-Marie with its supporting fires, and the tank squadron would simply have to barrel down the length of the airstrip to reach it with supporting paratroops in case of real trouble. In addition, while Major Thimonier was not as popular with his men as the departing Major Archambault, the company commanders were men with considerable experience. In addition to Gendre and Desiree, there were Captain Guilleminot and Lieutenant Makoviak. The later fate of the 3rd BT left the indelible impression that the unit had always been worthless. An investigation of its background shows that this was not so. The year before, it had fought very well in the fortified camp of Nasan, where its 12th company under Makoviak had formed the rear guard when the camp was evacuated. Although there had been uncertainty among the unit's mountain tribesmen when it appeared that their native region was to be abandoned to the communists, only 20 men deserted. The rest of the battalion had performed extremely well during the difficult and costly mop-up operations Flanders and Pike in the southern part of the Red River Delta. The 3rd BT had particularly distinguished itself in October 1953 during Operation Seagull, in which it was for a time the lead element in a multi-regiment operation that badly mauled the 320th People's Army Division in the limestone hills and crags around Phu Noc Quan. In that operation, it had worked under the command of Colonel de Castries, and side by side with the 313 DVLE. Thus, when it replaced the thoroughly demoralized 301st BVN in December 1953, there was no reason to believe that the unit would not give a good account of itself. If anything, its morale was expected to rise, since it was again being committed in its own Thai hills. This appeared to be the case. The battalion began fraternizing with its fellow tribesmen from the neighboring villages of Ban Khael and Ban Long Thong. Some intelligence reports cautioned that the Thai tribesmen in the garrison of Dien Bien Phu might be subverted and demoralized through their contacts with the local population, but this was readily discounted by the French officers who worked with them and who knew them. Furthermore, as long as the population lived in the valley, it was virtually impossible to enforce a ban on fraternization. Such a ban would also run against the French policy of attempting to win over the populace to the nationalist side. There was no such problem on stark, abrupt Strongpoint Gabriel. Although no longer called the torpedo boat, Gabriel, now totally denuded of all vegetation, looked more like a warship than ever, an effect heightened by its 8-gun battery of super-heavy 120mm mortars and the battalion's own battery of 4 81mm. The Algerians of the 5-7 RTA had truly worked hard in preparing their position. In an inter-strongpoint competition proposed by Colonel de Castri, in which a team of outside officers would judge each position on the base of the solidity of its construction and the excellence of the tactical layout, Gabriel had won hands down. Its men had been given a large cash prize by de Castri. The battalion blew it in an enormous nuba, a Muslim festive dinner, on January 28, 1954, to which it invited de Castri and most of his senior staff officers. Indeed, it was the only strong point which had two complete defensive lines. Its mortars were well dug in and were well registered on all their most likely targets. The 4 rifle companies were also well protected. The 5-7 was solid. It had arrived in Indochina in the middle of the first heavy communist offensives of the spring of 1951 and had then been thrown into combat without any heavy weapons. For 2 long years, it had been in charge of the defense of one of the vital sectors covering the approaches to Hanoi from the north, and had acquitted itself of its task with high marks for competence and courage. It had Frenchmen and Algerians, among both officers and NCOs, and, prior to its arrival at Dien Bien Phu on Christmas Day 1953, it had been re-equipped with new uniforms and weapons, including infrared sniper scopes. The 5-7 RTA could be relied upon to give a good account of itself. This reliance was, it turned out, fully justified. The battalion's commanding officer, Major Roland de Mecquenem, had his unit well in hand. After a tour of duty with the NATO Standing Group in Washington from 1950 until 1952, de Mecquenem had spent 2 years with the Algerians in the Red River Delta and was shortly to be returned home. In fact, his replacement, a Major Ka, had arrived on Gabriel on March 2nd, but de Mecquenem had insisted upon staying on so as to be able to instruct his successor in all the details of the defense of the position. Both officers were still on Strongpoint Gabriel when the battle started. Finally, one of the Thai auxiliary companies, the 416th, also had been assigned to Gabriel, but thoroughly demoralized after its harrowing trek from Lai Chau, the 416th was assigned little more than housekeeping functions. It melted away once the battle began. The central sector, with its cluster of main strongpoints and its outlying satellite strongpoint Beatrice, was of course the heart of the fortress. It fell into 2 major subdivisions, the hill positions east of the Nam Yum River and the flatland positions to the west of it. So long as Beatrice was in French hands, communist artillery could be kept at arm's length from the airfield. And as long as the hill positions of Dominique and Elian were in French hands, it was possible to move with a certain amount of safety within the fortified camp. On the western side, the communist hill line positions were far enough away from the heart of Dien Bien Phu, which the French soon began to call the center of resistance, CR. The full weight of French firepower was expected to keep communist assault troops sufficiently far away to prevent them from becoming too dangerous. Thus, much, if not all, depended on Beatrice. Little wonder, then, that its defense and the overall command of the central sector as well had been entrusted to Colonel Gaucher's Mobile Group 9. This unit had been built around the 13th DBLE and included the 3-3 RTA on Dominique and another Moroccan battalion which had not been brought into the valley. The 13th DBLE was one of those legendary units of the French Army which had never lost a battle even during the worst days of World War II. As part of the Free French Forces in Africa, it had fought along with the British 8th Army in Libya. In fact, it had been entrusted with the difficult mission of covering the retreat of that army into Egypt when it was pursued by German Field Marshal Rommel's Afrika Korps. At a desert oasis called Bir Hakeim, it made a last-ditch stand despite several offers to surrender. Only after it had bought the time necessary for the 8th Army to take up new positions did the 13th break out of the encirclement. With this to live up to, Beatrice was obviously in excellent hands. The position itself, though considered well-built by everyone who had visited it, was overshadowed by neighboring jungle hills. There simply had not been time enough to burn down tens of square miles of surrounding jungle. Hence, a communist unit could approach Beatrice to within a few hundred yards with almost total impunity. The position itself was made up of three round hills grouped in the form of an irregular triangle. Beatrice 2 and 3 overlooked Road 41, while Beatrice 1 faced the jungle hills to the north. All three positions comprised several well-dug-in bunkers, and the command post bunkers were placed in the center of the triangle. A small outpost bunker stood somewhat apart on a little knob to the west of Beatrice 1. Slit trenches connected the various positions with each other, and well-dug-in automatic weapons covered all the likely approaches to Beatrice. These were also placed in a manner to be able to give mutually supporting fires to the defensive positions within the strongpoint. By early March 1954, Major Paul Pegot, the commander of the 313 atop Beatrice, had done all that was possible to fortify the strongpoint with the means available. Yet he could not prevent the steady drain on his forces necessary to keep the road open from Beatrice to the main position at Dien Bien Phu. When the attack on Beatrice actually began on March 13th, the total strength of the battalion had been reduced to about 500 men instead of 700, and most of its platoons were commanded by sergeants. In fact, one French intelligence source maintains that there was only one officer left per company, plus a very small battalion staff. Strongpoint Dominique contained the highest terrain features of the main center of resistance. Its peripheral positions D1 and D2, 530 and 560 meters high respectively, towered by about 200 feet above the valley bottom and dominated by almost 100 feet neighboring Strongpoint Elian. This meant that Dominique also included important artillery observatories for the whole fortress. The trouble with Dominique was that it was too widespread and incoherent for an effective defense. The 583 soldiers, 90 non-coms, and 15 officers of the 33 RTA, whose mission was to defend Dominique, were strung out over a position whose maximum length was almost 2 miles and maximum width almost 1 mile. And while D1 and D2 were hill positions straddling Road 41, D3 was in the flatlands along the Namyom, where the depots were supposed to have been dug in, and D4 was altogether on the west bank of the river. Here again, the egg shapes reassuringly drawn on the maps around those isolated positions meant nothing. There were no continuous barbed wire entanglements of minefields between D1 and D4. And there was plenty of low underbrush and open space in the ravines around the Namyom for the enemy to infiltrate. In the engineering reports, Dominique was the only position rated as bad, and Captain Garandeau's Algerians were, like the Moroccans on neighboring Elian, just as good as their leaders. They fought when well led, but were likely to collapse if their unit commanders were killed or wounded. In the case of Dominique, there existed several reassuring factors. The position was shielded from almost all sides by peripheral strongpoints, and it was within easy reach of the paratroop battalions of GAP-2, whose role would be to back up the faltering garrisons of the outlying strongpoints. When it became clear that the battle would soon be joined, Dominique was reinforced accordingly. D-1 was held by the 9th Company of the 33 RTA and an artillery observation detachment. It was reinforced in March by a battery of 6 120mm heavy mortars from Colonel de Castries' headquarters reserve. On outlying D2, Captain Garandeau had set up his own command post with 11th Company and Headquarters Company. D2 was further reinforced on January 9, 1954, by the arrival of the 425th CSM, one of the Thai auxiliary companies. D3 was held by 12th Company, with the exception of one platoon which acted as Colonel de Castries' honor guard at his own headquarters. Finally, D4 was held by 10th Company. A new strong point, baptized D5, was inserted between D2 and D3 on March 7th and was occupied by 5th Company of the 2nd Thai Battalion. Finally, on March 15th, when the battle had already begun, it became apparent that the defense of Dominique was vital to the survival of the fortress. A new strong point, D6, was therefore hastily inserted between D1 and D2. But this is part of a later story. To the south of Dominique lay Eliane. If any part of the Battle of Dien Bien Phu earned a place in the annals of human heroism, it was the single-minded defense, to the last cartridge and the last man, of these two blood-drenched hillocks. It is not without reason that the Viet Minh forces, after the battle was over, built the monument commemorating their dead atop Eliane II, although that position was overshadowed both in height and size by many others. But for none other had the battle raged for so long and so bitterly, and none other had cost as much in dead and wounded. Eliane had first been occupied by the 3rd BT and the 5th BPVN. Prior to the outbreak of the battle, it had become the home of the Moroccans of the 14 RTM. Its flatland rear area housed one of the engineering companies and a company of paratroopers from the 8th BPC. When the battle developed, Eliane would subdivide like an amoeba and sprout new strong points. But two of the most important features of Eliane were not even located inside its position. They were two hills situated to the east of Eliane II, which had not been included in the French defensive perimeter because they would have added little to its strength. The northernmost hill, however, had been equipped with a rudimentary defensive position in order to deceive the enemy as to French intentions in that sector. Actually, it was held during daylight by an outpost garrison and at night by three-man patrols. In view of its fictitious character, the hill became known as Mont Fictif, in English perhaps Phony Hill or Phony Mountain. The other hill soon became no man's land, and was, in view of its bareness, referred to as Mont Chauve, which translates as Baldy Hill or Baldy Mountain. Both Phony Hill and Baldy Hill were to play roles in the drama of Eliane. On the left flank, beyond the Nam Yum, lay the hard core of Dien Bien Phu. That is, the bulk of its garrison, the airfield, and all the artillery, with the exception of two batteries of 105s of the 24 RAC located near Dominique 4. The two strong points which covered that area, Huguette and Claudine, were military abstractions without any salient terrain features. This is best shown by the maps and aerial photographs of the first few days of March 1954, none of which agree as to the exact outlines of the positions. For example, some of these maps show the headquarters area as being part of Claudine, while others show the various headquarters installations in a sort of no-man's land in the center of the strongpoint cluster. Only during the battle, when one strongpoint after another, and often a particular position within a strongpoint, had to fight for its life, were the various positions of Huguette and Claudine to take on an individual character of their own. Both strongpoints had another special feature in common, at least at the beginning. They were both garrisoned by Foreign Legion infantry battalions. Claudine was held by Major Coutance 113 DBLE, while Huguette was defended by the 1st Battalion 2nd Foreign Legion Infantry of Major Clemenceau. Like all the other strongpoints, both Claudine and Huguette had their share of Thai Mountaineer Auxiliary Companies, two of them on Claudine and three on Huguette. On the side facing the enemy, Claudine, tucked away behind the elaborate barbed wire wave breaker, looked like a normal strongpoint. Her inner side, facing the core of the fortress, looked more like a strange factory producing weird machinery in shops without a roof and without walls. Here was the major depot and headquarters zone of Dien Bien Phu, with its repair shops, its power generators, motor pools, and hospital. This was Main Street, Dien Bien Phu. Close to Claudine 1, there were the main artillery and mortar positions, comprising 16 105s and the 155mm guns of the counter-battery, plus Lieutenant Bergot's airborne mortar company with its 8 120s. At the eastern edge of Claudine, where the position abutted on the Nam Yum, was the headquarters of the armored squadron. Here, the engineers had dug deep pits from which the turrets of the tanks emerged with their cannon like so many menacing war elephants. Just to the north of C1 and C2, where the Pavie track joined Road 41, were the heart and soul of Dien Bien Phu, Colonel de Castries' own headquarters with its corrugated steel roof, the only one at Dien Bien Phu, deeply buried under layers of beams and sandbags. Across the road, on a slight rise along the Nam Yom, was Colonel Longley's GAP-2, next to which was Dien Bien Phu's main hospital. The hospital began as a comfortably small affair with 44 beds for seriously wounded and well-appointed dugouts for the operations, X-ray, and recovery rooms. This was before it became clear that not one wounded man would leave the hell of Dien Bien Phu by air. The hospital, with its 44 beds, soon cared for perhaps 3,000 wounded, and, from a model field installation, it became an apocalyptic charnel house in whose dark recesses the wounded would lie in the muck and stench of their own blood and excrement. The main hospital was run by Major Paul Groin, M.D., a reserve officer who had served in Indochina for over 10 years, and who, with his completely bald head, looked like a Roman emperor with rimless glasses. Groin commanded the Mobile Surgical Detachment, ACM-29, reinforced in February 1954 by the Vietnamese Army's ACM-44 under Lieutenant Guindre, M.D. Each surgical detachment had enough personnel to supervise a small field hospital and to perform all the chores of the surgery room. In addition, of course, each one of the battalions inside Dien Bien Phu had its own doctor and male nurses and corpsmen. Yet all this was ridiculously inadequate, and the local medical personnel knew it even before the battle. On January 19, 1954, Captain Reeve, M.D., then the chief medical officer at Dien Bien Phu, sent a report to de Castries stating that the small number of available hospital beds was beneath comment. The result was that 3 complete airborne surgical teams, ACP, complete with their doctors and operating room equipment, had to be parachuted into Dien Bien Phu in the midst of the battle. ACP-3 was parachuted onto isolated Isabel, while ACP numbers 5 and 6 were parachuted into Dien Bien Phu itself. Number 6 was installed on shell-smothered Elian, where it kept operating and treating the wounded under incredible conditions until the last day of the battle. As losses piled up and wounded could not be evacuated, 2 complete blood banks were parachuted in on April 15th and 18th, as well as an X-ray machine, to replace the one in the main hospital which had been destroyed. All this was installed in the central recesses of Strongpoint Claudine, as well as signal companies, gasoline depot units, ammunition detachments, a quartermaster unit, a military police detachment, an army post office, number 74.144, and small detachments of operatives of the French equivalent of the Central Intelligence Agency, referred to as Section 6, and DOP. The latter employed their own force of Mayo tribesmen, who were quartered near de Castries' headquarters, in their own dugouts, and disappeared into the nearby mountains on their mysterious errands. The women and children of the Mayo intelligence agents lived with them inside the fortress, for there was a heavy price on their heads if the Viet Minh captured them. In a depression near the Nam Yum, between GAP-2 and the hospital, huddled Dien Bien Phu's cemetery. Soon, the number of dead required that graves be dug with the help of the bulldozers, and soon thereafter, the dead would simply be buried where they fell, in shell holes or collapsed dugouts and trenches. Strongpoint Huguette's key job was to protect and keep open the bulk of the airfield, with Amery 3 holding the northernmost edge of the strip and Dominique 4 ensuring the defense of its parking area and taxi stand. Huguette 1 straddled the Pabi track at a point about 2,700 feet from the beginning of the runway. H-2 was also located on the Pabi track, but only 900 feet to the northwest of the beginning of the runway. H-3 was inserted a few hundred feet farther to the south when the increasing pressure and boldness of the enemy showed, in January 1954, that his attack would be a serious one and that the airfield would be one of his prime targets. That is what led Colonel de Castries, on the recommendation of Major Clemenceau, to provide Huguette with an advanced first line in the form of 2 outlying strong points, H-4 and H-5, about 1,500 feet farther to the west of H-1, H-2, and H-3. On the aerial photographs taken at the time, they appear as mere squiggles of trenches and a few bunkers within the irregular star shape of their minefields and barbed wire entanglements. Yet the battle for the Huguettes was to become as merciless and bloody as that for the Elians. Still farther to the west, in the flattened ruins of what used to be the small Thai village of Muang Thanh, there was the already mentioned strongpoint Francoise, which could hardly be called a strongpoint. It was more what the French called a sonnet, a doorbell designed to warn the units behind it of the arrival of the enemy. Finally, barely visible through the haze of the valley bottom, lay, far to the south and all by itself, Strongpoint Isabel. Installed on a small hillock in a loop of the Nam Yum, Isabel was organized in 4 strongpoints located on the west bank of the river and in a 5th located across the river at the base of what was to have become Dien Bien Phu's auxiliary airstrip. If all of Dien Bien Phu was fated to be drowned in the monsoon rain and mud of late April and May, this problem scarcely arose on Isabel. Constructed in the middle of a swamp for the single purpose of providing artillery protection and hardly more than 2,000 feet long at its widest spot, Isabel's troops lived in the water from the beginning of the battle. The 2 infantry battalions, the artillery battalion, the tank platoon, and the Thai auxiliaries lived like animals in a cage, in total isolation for 40 days. Even the hell of the main position of Dien Bien Phu, with its 10,000 troops, seemed like a small paradise in comparison. On Isabel, there was no escape from anything, the shelling, the humidity, the wounded, and the dead. The 4 western strongpoints of Isabel were tightly grouped in the fashion of a loose mosaic around the headquarters cluster in the center. To the east, there was the famous bridge, for whose construction Major Sudra had in part filled in the Nam Yum, and beyond that bridge, which was surrounded on the eastern bank of the Nam Yum by a narrow neck of trenches, was the strange world of Isabel 5, an even more isolated sub-satellite whose official nomenclature was soon forgotten in favor of the name of the young lieutenant who commanded the 431st, 432nd, and 434th Thai Auxiliary Companies. And so it was that Isabel 5 became the only position in the valley to be named after a human male, and one who was part of the garrison at that, Strongpoint Weem. Shaped like the blade of a pickaxe whose handle would be the north-south line of the Pavi track and whose arrow point would focus on the Nam Yung Bridge, Strongpoint Weem jutted out into the no-man's land where the enemy roamed until the last day of the battle. But scores of men paid with their lives just to supply and relieve it regularly, for the Nam Yung Bridge was under constant observation and fire by the enemy. But in those bygone days of mid-March 1954, the thoughts of the garrison at Isabel were not yet geared to the possibility of having to fight on alone. Between Isabel and Claudine, there lay the open flatlands of the valley bottom, with its little midway post, Marcel, and the seemingly unstoppable power of Captain Eruvé's armored bisons, which would surely be capable of plowing through any kind of communist infantry force. Any kind, that is, except one solidly entrenched and dug in with sufficient anti-tank bazookas. Registration fires of the artillery pieces of the 310 RAC had shown that Captain Libier's guns could easily reach the southern part of Dien Bien Phu and place any would-be attackers of Elian under murderous flanking fires. Conversely, the heavy artillery from Claudine could box in Isabel under its own fires on a moment's notice, and to the south, hardly a mountain chain beyond the valley, was friendly Laos. Though the immediate border areas were occupied by Viet Minh forces, just as the Thai highlands of Vietnam were, there still existed throughout the Laotian mountain areas the French commando forces of the GCMA, whose radio operators quietly cut into the radio traffic at Isabel, and who constituted a sort of reassuring external presence. Everyone agreed, even before the battle started, that if Dien Bien Phu were to be crushed by overwhelming communist forces, the best road to salvation lay to the south, beyond Isabel. There had been a few rain squalls on March 13, 1954, over the valley of Dien Bien Phu, but the air transport traffic had not been impeded by them. Nor had the intermittent communist harassing fires been any worse than usual. Almost a decade later, I was to sit in the Museum of the Revolution in Hanoi, where the North Vietnamese government keeps its mementos of past struggles, watching a film put together by Roman Lazarevich Karman, the Russian cinematographer, and to see through the eyes of an anonymous Viet Minh cameraman what the battlefield looked like that fateful late afternoon. The particular sequence had apparently been taken from the mountain hills overlooking Claudine and Huguette, clearly visible in their sandy outlines against the lush green of the surrounding rice fields. The whole French position looked, as so many observers had already stated, like a huge Boy Scout jamboree, with its tents, the rising smoke of the many cooking fires, and the laundry laid out to dry over the strands of barbed wire. For a few seconds, the camera seemed to zoom in on the flapping laundry and on a Jeep racing like a little toy on the dusty road between Claudine and Huguette. And then this whole bucolic scene suddenly dissolved in what seemed to be a fantastic series of ferocious black tornadoes which completely covered the neat geometrical outlines of the French positions. The communist bombardment of the French fortress of Dien Bien Phu had begun. It was March 13, 1954. The hour was 1700. 5. Assault. On the Vietnamese side, March 13th was the payoff for almost 5 months of backbreaking labor, the transportation through hundreds of miles of jungle of thousands of tons of supplies, and the gamble of General Giap and his able chief of staff at Dien Bien Phu, General Hoang Van Thai. The Vietnamese previous experiences attacking French fortified positions had not been encouraging. The attack on the Marshal de Lattre line in the face of French artillery and fighter bombers in 1951-52 had been a failure. During the previous summer, the French garrison at Nassan, after again beating off a concentrated communist attack, successfully slipped out from the encirclement and was evacuated by air. Considering how long it took the Viet Minh logistical system to build up supply depots with human carriers and its small pool of Russian trucks, a last-minute French decision to pull out from Dien Bien Phu by air would leave the bulk of the communist battle force almost in the middle of nowhere, while the French would be free, thanks to their high airborne mobility, to concentrate their troops for an attack on the Viet Minh's sensitive rear bases to the north of the Red River Delta. Fortunately for General Giap, he was able to compel his French opposite number, General Navarre, to depart from his erstwhile policy of economy of forces. Through daring raids of the 308th Division into northern Laos and of the newly formed 325th Division in the direction of the Mekong in December 1953 and January 1954, Giap led Navarre to fritter away his last mobile reserves into a series of smaller airheads at Muang Sai and Seno. Those airheads not only absorbed whatever reserve tonnage the French Air Force Transport Command could make available, but also prohibited, as was seen, an adequate supply build-up at Dien Bien Phu during that crucial phase, and rendered impossible the timely evacuation of the French forces there, had such a decision ever been made. Yet, to judge from the slowness of the communist build-up at Dien Bien Phu, the chances for a successful evacuation might have been good in mid-December 1953 and again in mid-January 1954. After the retirement of Independent Regiment 148 from the Dien Bien Phu Valley, only a light screen of communist regional forces remained in the area. 7 battalions of General Lê Quang Ba's 316th Division, reinforced by the division's artillery battalion 980, arrived in the general area of Dien Bien Phu only around December 17th. Having been delayed by the destruction of the Thai light companies. General Vuong Thua Vu's crack 308th Division, composed almost entirely of volunteers from Hanoi and the province of Binh Phuc Kien, started its march toward Dien Bien Phu on November 28th under a steady pelting by French fighters and bombers, which to all appearances had little effect. The division arrived in the Dien Bien Phu area during the last days of December, inflicted some severe losses on the reconnaissance stabs of GAP-2, but then moved on for its raid toward Luang Prabang. It was to return to Dien Bien Phu only in late January 1954, and its arrival gave rise to the French intelligence estimate that the general attack on Dien Bien Phu was to begin on January 25th. Finally, Regiment 57 of the 304th Division under Colonel Hoang Khai Tien reached Dien Bien Phu on January 24th, after a forced march of 10 days across more than 200 miles of jungle from Phu Tho. Thus, a total of 28 infantry battalions with 37,500 combatants constituted the hard core of the infantry siege force. As the battle wore on, the Communist High Command threw another 10,000 reserves, some of them almost raw recruits, into the fight. It also brought in 3 more regular battalions from the 304th and 316th Divisions and from Regiment 148. But this was not all. Had the communist force been made up entirely of infantry, the French garrison, though one-third the enemy's strength, could probably have withstood the assault, thanks to its massive firepower and air support. What really broke the back of the French resistance at Dien Bien Phu was General Vu Hien's 351st Heavy Division. The concept of the heavy division was one which the Viet Minh had inherited from its Chinese communist and Russian mentors. It was this type of massive utilization of concentrated artillery fire which time and again smashed the German front in Russia. In Vietnam, where relatively few well-trained artillerymen were available, the concentration of such firepower in a single large unit made a great deal of sense. The 351st had come a long way since its humble beginnings in 1945, when the Viet Minh artillery was equipped with some antiquated French and Japanese mountain guns. One by one, its battalions had gone through the Chinese communist artillery training camps at Qingxi and Lung Chau. At first equipped mostly with American 75mm howitzers captured from the Chinese nationalists, the division received 48 American 105mm howitzers in 1953, mostly from freshly captured Korean stocks. By mid-December 1953, the 675th Artillery Regiment, probably equipped with 24 pack howitzers of 75mm caliber and 20 heavy mortars of 120mm, arrived in the Dien Bien Phu area in the wake of the 308th Division. During the first week of January, the 45th Artillery Regiment, equipped with 9 batteries of 4 105mm howitzers each, also arrived in Dien Bien Phu, followed shortly by the 367th Anti-Aircraft Regiment, equipped with 36 Russian flak pieces. Later on, at least parts of the 237th Artillery Regiment, equipped mostly with heavy mortars, was also reported in the Dien Bien Phu area. In addition, the infantry divisions, which were part of the siege ring, also brought along with them their normal complement of heavy weapons and mortar battalions, as well as their own light anti-aircraft pieces. While exact figures will no doubt remain forever unknown, French ground and air observation, which was far from perfect, estimated that the enemy finally fielded at Dien Bien Phu at least 48 field howitzers of 105mm caliber, 48 pack howitzers of the 75mm caliber, 48 heavy 120mm mortars, and at least as many 75mm recoilless rifles, whose effect became murderous as the communists began to occupy the outer edge of Dominique, and at least 36 heavy flak guns. Finally, as the battle reached its climax, Viet Minh began to employ Soviet-built Katyusha multi-tube rocket launchers. In all, then, the communists possessed at least 200 guns above the 57mm caliber. On the French side, the maximum number of such guns ever available amounted to 60, and dropped to an average of less than 40 within a week after the battle had begun. Since the French Air Force and naval aircraft could not hope to make up for a 4-to-1 inferiority in artillery, the disparity in firepower is almost sufficient explanation of the outcome of the whole battle. The real surprise to the French was not that the communists had that kind of artillery. In fact, its existence had been known for a year. What surprised the French completely was the Viet Minh's ability to transport a considerable mass of heavy artillery pieces across roadless mountains to Dien Bien Phu and to keep it supplied with a sufficient amount of ammunition to make the huge effort worthwhile. The French artillery specialists inside the fortress later estimated that they had been hit by approximately 30,000 shells of 105mm artillery and probably by over 100,000 shells of other calibers. This represents roughly 1,300 to 1,700 tons of munitions delivered to the valley between December 1953 and May 1954. In addition, about 6,500 tons of other supplies were brought to the valley by the Viet Minh. Essentially, then, the Battle of Dien Bien Phu was won along the communications lines leading from the Chinese border at Munam Quan over Provincial Road 13B to the Red River, and thence via Provincial Road 41 to Dien Bien Phu. The total length of that trek from the border, with all its detours, deep fords, substitutions for blown bridges, and alternate bypasses, was over 500 miles. It is difficult for the Western observer to imagine what it means to keep open 500 miles of jungle road in the face of the constant threat of aerial bombardment and strafing. It would have been extremely difficult had there been available modern road-building machinery and adequate protection against air attacks, as had been the case when American engineers built the Burma Road during World War II. The road to Dien Bien Phu required nearly 20,000 coolies and tribesmen impressed from the nearby villages, who slaved for 3 months to rebuild the shattered remains of Road 41 and to widen its turns to accommodate the artillery pieces and the 800 Russian-built Molotova 2.5-ton trucks, which were to become the backbone of the conventional supply system. The greatest challenge was met in the last 50 miles of the road, from the main supply dumps at Tuanjiao to the valley. On this stretch, the road had simply ceased to exist and had to be rebuilt from scratch. There also, it was closest to the French airfields, and for obvious reasons, most subject to French aerial surveillance. Yet, by what a French observer was to call the veritable mysticism of the road, everything was subordinated to the one gigantic, single-minded effort of feeding the front. It was coordinated by a top-level government front supply commission, which had full powers to requisition all men, machines, and draft animals available. The slogan, "Everything for the front, everything for victory," could be heard hundreds of times a day over the Viet Minh radio network and could be seen on posters and inscriptions throughout the Viet Minh zone. In a new edition of his small work on Dien Bien Phu, General Giap himself describes that effort. "Our troops opened the road and hauled the artillery pieces into our lines. During 7 days and seven nights, our troops raised hills, cut roads into the mountainsides, and opened the road to the artillery in the prescribed time. The secret was well kept, thanks to excellent camouflage, and the roads were kept open until the end of the battle. Night and day, the enemy bombed those very difficult roads, and nonetheless, our transports got through on the whole. Hundreds of thousands of Dong Kong, civilian coolies, women as well as men, surmounted perils and difficulties and spent more than 3 million workdays in the service of the front, in an indescribable enthusiasm." In actual fact, popular enthusiasm was backed by several solid regiments of combat engineers. The 151st Engineer Regiment of the 351st Division worked on Road 41 since early December 1953. It was reinforced in January 1954 by Regiment 88 of the 308th Division, which concentrated on the road stretch between Tuanjiao and Dien Bien Phu. Furthermore, 10,000 coolies were sent to work on the same stretch in February, reinforced by 5,000 raw recruits of Regiment 77. As the monsoon rains and intensified French bombardment began to have some effect on the communist supply system, another regiment of engineers, the 154th, was sent from the north-central Vietnamese province of Nam. Contrary to later allegations, the French high command was fully aware of the fact that all depended on whether the communist supply system could be effectively disrupted. Unfortunately, on the basis of the devastating effect of aerial bombardment on conventional supply lines in Europe, and a myth sedulously fostered in the early 1950s by the American proponents of heavy bomber warfare and used against the Ho Chi Minh Trail in 1965-66, the French Air Force shared the belief of its American colleagues that round-the-clock bombardment of the one communist communication axis with Dien Bien Phu would actually succeed. Apparently, the United States Air Force had failed, at least by late 1953, to inform its French colleagues in the Far East of the highly ineffective American aerial interdiction operations in North Korea in 1951-52, known under the code name of Operation Strangle. Strangle, as its name suggests, consisted of round-the-clock aerial bombardment of every road and rail line, of every tunnel and culvert, likely to be able to support the North Korean and Chinese supply system leading to the Korean front line. When faced with that challenge, the communists in Korea simply switched, as would their Vietnamese comrades, to hundreds of thousands of human carriers who did not depend upon bridges and tunnels and other obligatory passage points. To the best of anyone's knowledge, the communist supply system in Korea never failed its frontline soldiers, whereas the road-bound and mechanized American supply system on the other side was often affected by poor roads and bad weather. To this day, French Air Force sources agree that they had not been informed of the severe limitations of U.S. Air Force interdiction in Korea. Thus, they looked forward with confidence to a mission in which, for the first time, they would find the enemy in a clearly identified target area from which, to all appearances, he could hardly deviate. There were then, in other words, three battles of Dien Bien Phu. The first, fought by Colonel Longley's GAP-2 and the Thai Light Companies around the edges of the Highland Valley. The second, fought by the French Air Force against the Viet Minh combat engineers and coolies along Road 41. And the third, fought by the siege force around Dien Bien Phu against the garrison in the valley. The first battle, as we have seen, was lost probably by late December 1953. And in any case, by February 1954. Now it was the turn of Air Force General Jean Deschaux and the Northern Tactical Air Group, GATAC Nord, to try their luck. For that mission, Deschaux provided, until the beginning of April 1954, a theoretical maximum of 107 aircraft, 32 fighters, 45 fighter bombers, and 30 bombers. This meant the French had an effective maximum, considering combat losses, repair, and maintenance, of about 75 aircraft. This is a pitifully small force when one considers that the United States, in its air operations against North Vietnam in 1966, easily fielded 200 combat aircraft in a single raid. Yet the French force represented 75% of all the combat aircraft then available in all of Indochina. In addition to that pure interdiction force, some of the heavy flying boxcar C-119s of Transport Group 263 were used to deliver deadly cargoes of 6 tons of napalm on targets around Dien Bien Phu and along the communication lines. The total effort, under the command of Lieutenant Colonel Dussault's bombardment subgroup, was shared by both the French Air Force and the French Navy. On the Air Force side, Bomber Group 125, Tunisia, used B-26s, while the two fighter groups, 122, Saint-Ong, and 222, Languedoc, used Bearcat F-8Fs. The French Navy was at first represented by the aircraft carrier Arromanches, Captain Patou, followed in April 1954 by the American-built aircraft carrier Belleau Wood, loaned to the French Navy and manned by French personnel, Captain Morneau. Until the arrival of the Belleau Wood, the Arromanches carried the 3rd Carrier Assault Squadron, equipped with SB-2C Hell Divers, and the 11th Carrier Fighter Squadron, equipped with F-6F Hellcats. In addition, the French Navy also possessed the only aircraft in Indochina approaching long-range bombardment capability, 6 heavy privateer bombers of Squadron 28F. Designed for long-range anti-submarine patrols, the privateers were the ideal aircraft for deep penetration along the communist supply lines to Dien Bien Phu and were capable of delivering about 4 tons of bombs on their target. During the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, they also had been equipped with the new American Lazy Dog anti-personnel bombs, whose thousands of razor-sharp splinters have a deadly effect on unprotected humans caught in the open by them. The LDs, as they were called, were also to be used later by the United States in its air operations in Vietnam. 2 alternative techniques existed for the interdiction of the communist supply routes: the creation of 1 single major cut and its repeated bombing by daily waves of aircraft, or the creation of multiple cuts all along the communist routes of march. Both methods were tried by GATAC Nord on roads 13 and 41, and both failed. To assume that one could permanently interdict communist supply lines to Dien Bien Phu by 1 single large cut would have implied that the Viet Minh was incapable of hacking alternate routes through the jungle. As the French had found out during previous experience with road interdiction, the communists had been capable of quickly rebuilding roads that had been hacked into sheer cliffs by extremely perilous skip bombing. Also, the single-cut method would have permitted the Viet Minh to concentrate all its coolies in a single bypass area and to protect that point with the anti-aircraft artillery which had become available in increasing numbers. Hence, the decision was made to concentrate on the aerial interdiction on a few major points: the Red and Black River crossings, the junction at Konoi between roads 13 and 41, and the depot zone at Tuan Jieu. Also, it was planned to maintain smaller cuts all along the length of the road so as to compel the enemy to maintain numerous repair crews and bypass systems. As for the effectiveness of the enemy's anti-aircraft artillery, it had long gone beyond that of the isolated enemy machine gunner taking aim at a low-flying aircraft. As early as December 1952, French air reconnaissance had spotted 170 different flak positions in North Vietnam and had reported 55 aircraft hit. In 1953, the number of such positions found was 714, and the French reported 244 aircraft hit and then shot down. As General Giap built up his supply system for Dien Bien Phu, the whole length of the road became a veritable flak corridor along which the French aircraft had to run the gauntlet. The effectiveness of the communist fire at the beginning of the battle for Dien Bien Phu is illustrated by the fact that during the 2 weeks beginning with November 24, 1953, 45 French fighter bombers out of 51 that had been bombing and machine gunning the Viet Minh engineering regiments along roads 13 and 41 had been hit by communist anti-aircraft fire. One fighter bomber and two reconnaissance Crickets had been shot down. The situation worsened during the month of December as French aircraft began to attempt the interdiction of communist suppliers closer to the Chinese border and farther away from their own bases. A total of 367 combat sorties were flown and 49 aircraft were hit. On December 26th, the decision was made to divert increasing amounts of fire bombers and bombers to flak-suppressing missions in order to be able to interdict at least some of the flow of communist supplies without suffering unacceptable losses. Day after day, until the last day of the battle for Dien Bien Phu, the exhausted Navy and Air Force pilots dived into the flak corridor of Roads 13 and 41, spraying coolie columns and the rare trucks that could be spotted through the camouflage. At certain points, the Viet Minh had actually tied the tall treetops together until they formed a tunnel of vegetation. We shall never know how many thousands of coolies and mountain tribesmen impressed into the Dong Cong died under the strafing, the napalm, the delayed fuse bombs, and the hail of lazy dogs, but Giap's siege force never ran out of ammunition. As Giap was to say later to a French visitor, "We did construct our supply roads. Our soldiers knew well the art of camouflage, and we succeeded in getting our supplies through." Inexorably, like hundreds of little streams joining together to form a major river, the flow of Viet Minh coolies, trucks, thousands of hand-pushed bicycles, and pack animals converged on the valley. By December 27, 1953, the ultimate enemy buildup at Dien Bien Phu was estimated at 49,000 men, including 33,000 combatants. This estimate was revised upwards after the enemy feint of January 25th and the return to Dien Bien Phu of the 308th Division from its stab into Laos. When the battle finally began on March 13th, enemy combatant strength in the Dien Bien Phu area was estimated at 49,500 men, with 31,500 logistical support personnel. Another 23,000 communist support troops and personnel were strung out along the communication lines. On the French side, there was a total of 13,200 men in the valley, of whom about 6,600 to 7,000 could be counted on as frontline combatants, and of very unequal quality at that. Thus, in addition to enjoying firepower superiority, General Giap's forces also enjoyed a superiority in manpower of 5-1. And since it is accepted that 3-1 superiority will generally achieve victory in an infantry breakthrough, Giap's forces had met the conditions prescribed by the Viet Minh slogan, "Certain attack, certain progress." A Day, March 13, 1954. March 13th had begun in a routine manner in the fortress, yet two major problems had arisen. First, Strongpoint Beatrice now was so tightly surrounded that on March 11th and 12th, it had required a battalion reinforced by two tank platoons for the legionnaires to get drinking water from the nearby Nam Yum. On the morning of March 13th, Major Jean Chanel's 2nd BT had reopened the road to Beatrice in fierce hand-to-hand combat, but only after the roadsides had been liberally napalmed by French fighter bombers. As they went along the road, the Thai tribesmen finished off the burned enemy soldiers with their bayonets. Second, Dien Bien Phu's airfield was now constantly under communist fire. In fact, a single enemy 75mm mountain howitzer had been zeroed in on the airfield since February 1st. It had damaged and destroyed almost a dozen aircraft without being located by the French. Now the situation was far more serious, since there were perhaps a dozen enemy pieces firing at the airfield from several directions and with telling effect. On March 11th, one of the large American flying boxcars, which had had to remain at Dien Bien Phu overnight for engine repairs, was shot to pieces. It burned late into the night like a warning torch. On the following day, communist 105mm pieces opened up on the airstrip. The second round destroyed one of the Cricket reconnaissance aircraft. The fourth round destroyed another reconnaissance aircraft. At the same time, enemy artillery began to search for the other combat and reconnaissance aircraft parked in dugouts south of the field. The aviators were now clearly worried, as it became increasingly obvious that it would be impossible to maintain the fighter bombers and reconnaissance aircraft on which the French had counted so heavily to counteract the enemy's fire superiority. Since February, Dien Bien Phu's tiny control tower and air traffic control center, commanded by Captain Jean Charneau and known officially as Air Base 195, had been hit 8 times by communist shells. Each time a hit tore a hole in the pierced steel plates of the field, the combat engineers had to weld the break in full view of the enemy. What made the situation particularly awkward was that on March 12, 11 Bearcat fighter bombers at Dien Bien Phu were immobilized. Prevailing winds, combined with the high humidity at Dien Bien Phu, could have caused the trouble that day. Throughout the night of the 12th, the mechanics worked frantically to make the aircraft operational for the following day. But the enemy was aware of the prize within its grasp, and all night long communist shells fell in the aircraft pit area. One Bearcat was destroyed by a direct hit from a white phosphorus shell, while others sustained lighter damage which had to be repaired. Two of them, piloted by Sergeants Dussommeau and Barteau, were operational in the morning and flew 10 support sorties during the day. In the evening, they escaped to the French airfield at Vientiane, Laos. Other troubles were in store for Air Base 195 that day. A large C-46 Curtiss commando aircraft, which the French had used a year earlier to deport the nationalist Sultan of Morocco, was shot to pieces by Viet Minh artillery at 0830 as it prepared to depart. Until it was completely destroyed late in April, the Curtiss became a landmark for units fighting in the airfield area, and distances were often measured in meters beyond the Curtiss or south of the Curtiss. Shortly thereafter, a C-47 landing with supplies was shot to pieces while rolling on the ground, and early in the afternoon, another C-47 was hit, a fighter destroyed, and another damaged, until at about 1600, Air Base Control broadcast a QGO message. In the International Communications Code, the letters QGO stand for Interdiction to Land at Airport. Dien Bien Phu was sealed off from the outside world for the first time. The last French premise upon which a victorious defense of Dien Bien Phu was based, continued availability of uninterrupted air support, had proved false. At 15:10, two reporters landed in the last Dakota that landed safely. Both André Lebon and Jean Martinoff were old Indochina hands, and even Dien Bien Phu hands, since Lebon had jumped into the valley with the first wave on November 20th, and Martinoff had participated in the GAP-2's march to Sop Nau. Le Bon already had been wounded twice in earlier operations and looked forward to the big battle, which obviously was only hours away. He was an old acquaintance of the 1st Battalion 2nd Foreign Legion Regiment, on Huguet, and took a ride down to the strongpoint to get a general view of the situation at ground level. At the little officers' mess, there was talk only of the attack expected for that night. "What do you think, fellows?" said Le Bon. "It's going to be a great show this time." "You can say that again," said one of the lean Foreign Legion officers. "The curtain raiser already has begun. Jap's boys are already giving us their best cards. 81mm mortars, 120mm mortars, 105mm howitzers, the whole works. It's going to be like Nassan, only 10 times bigger. Or almost Verdun. This time they'll put all their big artillery here and will show us what they have learned about big war fighting." The friendly din of the mess was suddenly overshadowed by the heavy explosions of the 105s on the airfield. Le Bon decided that this was as good a time as ever to take a close look at what the enemy's firepower looked like. Both he and Martinoff raced back to the airstrip, now barren of any human activity, with the enemy's shells methodically proceeding with the destruction of a cricket reconnaissance plane and a damaged Dakota. "Get down into the ditch," said Le Bon to Martinoff. "I'll shoot a sequence on the destruction of the Dakota." Then 3 shells fell almost simultaneously. Martinoff died on the spot. Le Bon lost his right foot and was evacuated the same evening aboard one of the ambulance aircraft which had braved the enemy fire. His stay at Dien Bien Phu had been somewhat less than 6 hours. At headquarters, impending attack had not changed routine. The daily intelligence report received from Beatrice by radio on the morning of March 13th simply confirmed what already had been known, to wit, that Beatrice was now completely encircled by enemy approach works, some of which were within 50 meters of the first French positions. After the road had been reopened during the day by the BT-2 and the tanks, Lieutenant Colonel Gaucher, the commander of both the central sector of Dien Bien Phu and of the 13th Legion Half Brigade, drove to Beatrice in his open jeep for a last talk with Major Pegot. Pegot told Gaucher that his men were tired. In fact, not only tired, but nervous. Gaucher once more looked over the position and at the enemy, who now could be clearly seen on the facing slopes in spite of the intermittent French artillery fire, and in his deep voice grunted, "This is no time for nerves, because it's for tonight for sure." This was known to every legionnaire on Béatrice. In fact, to judge from the account of a survivor, Sergeant Kubiak, the men were less nervous than their officers. The day seemed to start like all the other days. We were busy with the eternal reinforcement of our positions. Orders rained down from every side, and to judge from the nervousness of our officers, it seems that something is in the air. As we comment upon this state of affairs, a legionnaire comes over and asks me that Lieutenant D wants to see me. Received the order to verify my machine guns, to be sure that they would fire the evening without jamming. In a few words, Lieutenant D informs me about the situation. I am flabbergasted, but nonetheless it seems